Enjoy all your favorite sports like never before at BetMGM. Sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. When you register with BetMGM, you'll get instant access to a variety of parlay selection features, live betting options, and the best daily promotions in the business. And with BetMGM at your fingertips, every play and every game matters more than ever. Place your money line, prop or parlay bets with the king of sportsbooks today. Sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. BetMGM and GameSense remind you to play responsibly. 21 plus and present in Ohio, subject to eligibility requirements. Rewards are non-withdrawable bonus bets that expire in 7 days. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER in partnership with MGM Northfield Park.
As humans, we're naturally driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. When I was looking to hire someone, it was so slow and overwhelming. I wish I had used Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform, with over 350 million global monthly visitors according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And Indeed doesn't just help you hire faster. 93% of employers agree Indeed delivers the highest quality matches compared to other job sites, according to a recent Indeed survey. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/podcast. That's Indeed.com/podcast. Terms and conditions apply.
Next time I got the intro.
Hey, everybody, and welcome back to the Kodiak Shack podcast. Today we have Paco Benitez. He's back. He's back on the podcast. This is our first time we've had someone come back on the podcast aside from Rain. So I dig it. We've got Bender here, and I, your host Vader, am always here, whether you like it or not. So Paco, thanks for coming back and chatting with us. You've had a lot of stuff kind of change over the last couple months since we've talked. So you want to give people updates on the merge and other things you're doing?
Yeah, sure. Going back to the beginning, I can't even remember. It was probably one of the first, five episodes that you had. Mm-hmm. I don't know what guest number I'm on. I probably should keep track of that. Yeah. But it's a pretty good award. I'm the first repeat offender.
That's right. We're happy to have you, too.
So thanks for having me. So let's see. What's been going on with me? Well, I'm retired, so we're recording this on Veterans Day, and I am actually like a card-carrying veteran of the U.S. military now, so that's pretty exciting news for me.
That is good.
Yeah, I've been busy with a grown-up job, so I have a real job now, so I have to figure out the joke is when you retire, you just have to figure out what you're going to wear to work every day, but since my job is, I travel a lot, but I'm not, I work at home in my office, and that makes my my clothing choices pretty easy most days, so...
Yeah.
Especially you get dressed from the waist up these days for most meetings.
Yeah, just some board shorts and then a collared shirt. Yeah.
That'll do it. Yeah.
Well, and for anybody who hasn't been paying attention, obviously, Paco runs The Merge, which is an awesome newsletter. Comes out every Sunday and solid content. Stealing his words, but he pretty much boils down and synthesizes all the information that's useful to have and then puts it out there for us. And Bender and I and multiple people on the ops side are reading it as well. And it keeps us smart on stuff. I dug the Taiwan 101 and the breakdown of that because honestly, I was saying underinformed is probably an understatement. But then he's also working at Shield AI. Which is the grown-up job? Is that what that is?
Yeah, right, that's my grown-up job. That's right. Yeah.
And then, but the thing that I kind of want to make sure we hit on is you spoke at some conferences, right? I think it was it AFA.
Yeah, I was actually on a panel for collaborative combat aircraft and autonomy at AFA in September, and that is actually just. I was a panel moderator at the NDIA's Air Armament Symposium about next generation air dominance weapons. So that was about an hour and a half panel I moderated. That was fun.
Yeah. So kind of breaking it down, I don't know what the numbers are. I've been to one AFA, so Air Force Association Conference. But I mean, there's what, thousands of people that go to that?
Yeah, I think I want to say the attendance number. This one was the most highly attended one. And I want to say it was something in the 14,000 range. And I'll tell you, I wasn't expecting going to the room for the panel and kind of like, hey, just be here at this time. We'll give you your mics and meet at the door. And we walk in, and this room has well over 2,000 people in it, like waiting for us to walk on stage to have this panel. Like, oh, I was not expecting that. I was expecting maybe 200, not 2,000. Yeah. So that was a little of a sticker shock.
Yeah, I bet. Well, it's funny. I think on a much smaller scale, like orders of magnitude less, the first time I was a mission commander at like a Red Flag or a Cope North or something. And I'm like, whatever, I brief all the time. Like I brief my like eight best friends, you know? And then I like stand up there as a mission commander. I'm like, oh geez. So I can only imagine that was probably exponentially more so.
Yeah. It's even more fun. I don't know how many, international mission commander gigs you've had to do. Those are special, extra special fun.
Oh yeah.
I got some pretty funny stories about that.
Yeah, well, it's funny because I have something similar. If you want to tell one, we'll trade stories on this.
All right, I'll tell you a debrief. Okay. A debrief of my mission commander upgrade. So there I was way back when, and we were in the UAE, and I want to say there was seven different nations, mostly Middle Eastern, but we had some French people there as well. And lo and behold, the mission for this international LFE from my mission commander upgrade is going to be this like compound complex CSAR with helicopters. We have an escort package. There's actually people out in the desert we have to go pick up. Pretty legit red air. And so we brief up the plan. It's like, the easiest plan is the best plan. So we keep it stupid simple. We go out there and, nothing happens. We didn't pick up the guy, someone else to come pick him up afterwards. We come back and I'm like, man, what a failure. I'm going to fail this ride so bad. So we get back in and there, and we had kind of like the pre-mass, the White Force, was a French, commander. And he'd been there forever. And I asked him like, hey, where's the escort guys? Like, oh, they left. What do you mean they left? Like, they didn't come to the debrief? Like, they're not coming to the debrief. Like, you have to debrief without them. I'm like, well, they need to be here because, like, they're supposed to pick up the guy. Like, we basically had a find and fix location to go get, Jack, like, in the first 5 minutes of this hour-long vol. And I want to know what happened the next 55 minutes. So they're like, yeah, do it without him. I'm like, okay. So I'm just going to wing it. And so I'm kind of on the stage. And again, this international stage, multiple, probably several hundred people in the audience. And I'm up there trying to tap dance through my upgrade without like a key piece of the information that I know that I'm going to need for the debrief. And so I'm kind of like talking through it. Here's a scenario, kind of re-cage everyone. And then I said, hey, where is the survivor? Is he here? And this guy raised his hand. I hear just like, motion in the back, and this guy raises his hand. I'm like, hey, like, I have some questions for you. So I start asking him like, hey, did you hear any of these radio calls? Like they've been calling you for 50 something minutes. And, the guy, he's just like sitting there looking at me, and the guy next to him leans over and goes, and he says, yes. Like, whoa, 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 hold on a minute. Are you telling me that, does he speak English? He's like, no. could you ask him why he didn't respond to any of the radio calls in like the 55 minutes in this vol that the helicopters have been trying to call? And the helicopters were, I think, Emirati. And this is a French guy, I think, on the ground. And they kind of whisper back and forth. He goes, he says his name's not Jack. I'm like, oh, kidding me? Like, so... So he heard every radio call, but because they're looking for Jack, which is, you know, our code name for just the survivor on the ground, his name is not Jack. And so he's like, well, that's not me. I'm not going to respond. And so we wasted several million dollars of jet fuel and hundreds of man hours of people's time based on that one little flaw. So
that's awesome.
Yeah.
That's that interoperability.
True story. That was my mission commander upgrade.
Yeah.
Did you pass?
Yeah.
I did. Very nice. Frustrating, but yes. I'm like, hey, I can't control this. Don't fight the scenario. Like, I'm not fighting the scenario. And then the other problem was I'm like, well, the helicopters knew where you were. Like, why didn't they just land? They saw you. And they're like, oh, yeah, they couldn't get close enough. I'm like, well, why not? Like, did you know where it was? I'm like, yeah. Like, well, why did the helicopters just land and pick him up? We couldn't see him. They couldn't get close enough. Like, well, why? Like, well, there was a Roz there. I'm like, yeah, the Roz is for the helicopter to be in. Like, oh, they thought they couldn't be in it. So they're in a 10-mile wheel around the survivor thinking they can't get any closer. I'm like, well, how the hell are you supposed to pick him up if you can't go in the Roz? Like, yeah, they hadn't thought that far ahead yet. And that's why they skipped the debrief. I'm like, oh, my God. You can't make this stuff up. You can't make this stuff up.
I love it.
We can't tell people, that story can't be shared. The incompetence.
Yeah. That's right.
Multinational military operations.
That's right. We're just gonna move on to the next thing. Let's go get tea.
Well, and then you wonder, like, what were they doing when we have all those like mass briefs and we brief the entire game plan, and it's like, what were they doing? Were they just not listening, or were they, you know? You wonder. I mean, my mission commander upgrade consisted of my instructor, like my the patch. You know, like, you got to put pen to paper. You got to put pen to paper. Like, you know, and then it goes horribly, as the most of them do. And he's like, never put pen to paper. And I was like, God, like, I was so furious. But we were,
simple works. The simpler, the better. And the less you speak, the more weight each word carries and stuff like that. You ever in those briefs and it's like a flight lead upgrade or something. And it's like, you know, hack. And it's like, oh my God, you're like the micro machine man from like those old commercials. Like, dude, everyone stop. Like, you're not allowed to talk for 10 seconds. Like, start, like, just talk slower. You're gonna, like, if I just talk faster and cram more words in it, I'll check all the blocks. Like, no. Like, talk less and transmit the stuff that matters, and then we'll go fly.
Well, like the backside of a cord card when it's just littered with contracts, and you're like, there's like 40 contracts on the back of this card. No one, not even C2, is going to keep track of every single one of these and who is responsible for what. You know, like you said, like, four contracts is probably all you really need, and then you'll be good.
Yeah, those are the best ones when you go out and you have your, after the mass brief, you kind of have your, you know, your package briefs and your top offs. So you go, all right, guys, like, the three things that we have to do right today are this, this, and this. If we fail to do any of those three things, we will all die. This mission will be a failure, and we're going to look like clowns. If we can get those three right, everything else is just, you know, icing on top.
Well, and I think that's where you really know who understands the problem set and who doesn't. Who can say, like, here are four or three or whatever pinch points, versus, like, I have to talk about everything because I'm not sure what's actually more or less important to success or failure. Bender, I don't know if I should say which country you're in. Bender, this was the TDY that you planned. That was a total debacle. Not on your part, but on the fact that it was like the location could not handle us showing up. And the State Department is like, you will show up. Can we say the location?
Yeah, go for it. I had a great time, by the way.
All right, so we're in Malaysia. Yeah, it was a solid TDY. Georgetown shawarma?
Yeah.
Solid shawarma.
Good shawarma. I'll tell
you, if you find yourself in Georgetown, Malaysia. But either way, so we're working with all the Malay pilots, and they're obviously like varying levels of like English proficiency. And we're doing like a large force engagement. So it's F-15Cs from Kadena and F-16Cs from Massawa. And then the Malaysian military, like, combination of their Hornet pilots, they've got like Hawk or Hawker or whatever that plane is. And and so we're in there, and I think I'm running it. I don't know. It's a fuzzy memory at best, but I'm up there, and we have like three separate like vulnerability windows for like a 90-minute bull. But I'm not going to be there the whole time, so I'm like, all right, talking to one of the Malaysian pilots. I'm like, all right, you have the hammer then, and then I'm going to show up and I'm going to take the hammer. And then now, like, lastly, this person's going to have the hammer. And I like sit down and one of our really smart younger dudes is like, do you think they know what you're talking about when you say they have the hammer? And I'm like, that's a good point. Like, do you know what an idiom is? Yes. You know, stop using them. But, so yeah, it was pretty comical. Luckily everybody was on the same page, but it's one of those things where we just get used to our jargon. And then you interact with people who may have a varying level of, you know, English competency and you're like, well, I'm using slang on a language that is, you know, a second or possibly third language. That's doesn't breed success normally.
I mean, I'm reminded of the, back in my former life, before I was in the Air Force, and I was in the Marine Corps, there was a, I was a NCO. One of the things we used to do with some of the younger guys is we do like the peanut butter and jelly leadership thing. You guys ever heard of that?
No, I haven't.
All right, that's great. So, so Bender, you're going to be my guinea pig. So, Bender, I want you. So basically, we set out kind of a loaf of bread, a knife, a jar of peanut butter, and a jar of jelly, and I go, okay. I want you to lead me. Tell me how to make a peanut butter and jelly sandwich. Go.
You actually want me to do?
Yeah, okay. Like, well. So like the first, it's usually like, okay, well, and there's different ways to make it, right? And so generally it'll start something like, oh, well, I like to start the peanut butter. So let's put the peanut butter on the bread. So you just pick up the jar of peanut butter, just smash it on the loaf of bread. I'm like, oh, well, that's not what I was talking about. Like, well, be clear and concise and correct. What do you want? And so you finally get to the point of like, okay, if I give articulately exactly what I want from you, like there should be very minimal questions and we have a level of expectation between the two of us. So that is a style of leadership. Then you have the style, which is like, I don't care how it gets done. Just deliver me a peanut butter and jelly sandwich and, you know, don't break any laws or kill any people and give me that peanut butter sandwich. So there's a few different, you know, styles, but that's always a fun one to walk people through. Yeah. And it's kind of funny because you'll see the different ways and things that people, you know, mess it up. Like put the, now I've got peanut butter on one slice and jelly on the other. Okay. Now put the two slices together. You put them together backwards. Or it's like, you're like, well, this is terrible. What a terrible sandwich. So you make a big mess. Everyone has a lot of fun.
So many unforeseen variables that you never think of because you just assume a level of competency.
That's right. That's right. They should do that at weapons school. Eh?
Yeah. Oh, well, that's like, you know, having someone else, you know, how good are my products? Like have someone who wasn't there for the mission planning, like brief this scenario. And it's like, we'll know how well it's all put together if that person can just like derive what our intent is from the products that we provide them.
Yeah, that's right. That's exactly right. So speaking of, you mentioned Kadena F-15s. You are now actively flying the F-15C, right? You've had a couple flights?
Raging around. Three sorties. My last one was not effective weather, so it's good.
So what was your first impression going from the, you know, the Viper backwards technologically in some ways to the C model, but now you're flying a, you know, there's a tennis court behind you if you turn around.
It's totally different. I mean, obviously it's still a fighter. Luckily, tactical formation, like, you know, turning into regents, like it's just flying fighter, which is nice. Cause I almost forget I am flying the C model when I'm like on a rejoin, I'm just like looking at a C model. So I'm like, oh yeah, that makes sense. But like
the references are the same, but that all it's the relationships are. Yeah,
exactly. And like, you know, you bleed energy a little faster, which actually makes like a rejoin easier. Because if you get hot on the rejoin, you're going real fast. You can just like, when you pull the power back, you start slowing down. Where in the F-16, you're like, oh, this is going to be terrible. And you can't like stop the jet in the F-16 because you'll just climb or you'll go belly up. So yeah, I'd say overall, the flying has been good. I mean, I enjoy flying it. It definitely feels more like almost like a boat, or they refer like a Cadillac, where it kind of like just like smoothly floats along the sky, where the F-16, I wouldn't refer to it as like smooth, you know, like it was more like very deliberate, where the C model seems like more like flying like a real airplane. I was just talking about it today to Bender. Oh, go ahead.
No, I was going to say that's by design, right? Like the F-16 was the first fighter designed to be aerodynamically unstable. And so the computers keep it right side up and flying, where the F-15 is cables and pulleys with some basic flight control augmentation. And so it's, it could fly with, it's a pretty stable airplane. You can put a lot of crap on it without being too, you don't have to be too ginger with it. Where I know like the Dash one and the Viper, you have, I can't even keep track. I saw it one day and I'm like, what is that? Like, oh, it's our configuration, all of our limitations when you put things on the wings and different, stations. And I'm like, oh my God, like we just throw things on the jet and go fly.
Yeah, 1-2, that thing's a nightmare. It's almost like it's some experiment just to mess with us, because you're like, it's not even straightforward.
It would be pretty everything fun.
Has yeah, I think the...
It'd be pretty fun to do an experiment where you take, 20 different F-16 pilots and I'll have them research one configuration and the limitations and see what they come up with. Because they will all, I bet you get 10 different answers from 20 different patches.
Yeah, so my last assignment, we were in a multi MDS squadron. So we had F-15s and F-16s in test. And, we do a lot of, all of our flights are basically mixed formation. And I got a couple of Viper rides too. And the easiest thing is, all right, who's got the configuration? Like you. All right, that's it. Like one person's going to look at it. One person's going to make a decision. And we're going to go with that decision. Like no one else will look at it because you will come up with a different answer. And I think you guys are the experts, having flown the Viper. But I want to say one of the configurations is one of like your, air-to-air configuration, where if you're supersonic and then shoot the missile, now you're out of limits because the new configuration without the missile is like subsonic only, and the jet in theory would go out of control or something or have some flutter issue, which I think that's hilarious. Like that's completely tactically irrelevant.
Yeah. Well, the plus side, so now knowing a little bit about both, is that in the F-16, you can actually step between what and pick whatever missile you want. So that's like the, hey, make sure you don't shoot that one. Like step to another missile so you don't put yourself out of control at like the high 30s above the Mach. You're like, sure, that makes total sense. I'll do that. The upside.
That's right. In the 15, you can only step between missile types.
Exactly.
Right.
Yeah.
The C model is probably the same as the E.
Well, yep. Yeah, that's exactly right. The thing that was convenient about the F-16 is there was no OWS, so the overdue warning system, which I don't know if that's what it stands for, but that's what I'm going to say it stands for. But so the OWS, like, it's effectively just monitoring you at all times, and it gives you a current readout for your lateral stick deflection and altitude, airspeed, all that stuff. So if you're going 700 miles an hour, it's like you're limited to 6.5 Gs or something like that. And it tells you in the HUD, like, don't pull around 6.5 or I'm going to say you overg'd. We're in the F-16. It doesn't. So like asymmetrically overg'ing the F-16 is like part of the tactic. Like it's not even like, oh no, you just do it. Where in the C model, it's like, this has to be a straight pull or you will overg' that jet. And you're like, that's a new thing for me.
I feel like asymmetric overg's are some kind of engineering make-believe thing that they made up just to mess with operators.
Yeah. Like you better not do it. Like, yeah, I don't get it and this is one thing. There you go, Paco. I have the ultimate question for you because you've been around, and this is an F-16 thing, and apparently it was not a Strike Eagle thing. So the F-16 is limited to 5.5 Gs if it has a bomb parent mounted or mounted on like a brew or a turret, if it's an inert or if it's alive. And I don't know why it's or if it's 500 pound or 2000 pound. And I don't know why it's 5.5 Gs always. Does that make any sense?
So in the F-15E, it's, I'll probably get it wrong, 4.8 asymmetric and 6 symmetric. Uh-oh, I think we lost Bender.
Yeah, he'll come back.
He'll come back. Yeah, so those engineering limitations that you see for weapons, they're not engineering limitations 99% of the time. They are fiscal management limitations. So if you look at the cost complexity when you do like weapon certification through Seek Eagle, the Air Force Seek Eagle office is the people who do all that. When you look at carriage, jettison, store separation, emergency jettison, employment, and you go through all these different considerations, you can, getting to 5.5 or 6 Gs, depending on your airframe, is kind of a baseline. Like it's pretty standard. to get to like, hey, I really would like a, you know, a 7G release for this weapon. Like, oh, that's like $50 million in 10 years. We have to go to the wind tunnel. Like, we have to do this. We have to do that. Like, oh my God. And you're like, do you really, like, what scenarios are you going to do this? You're like, well, I just would like it. I mean, I can think of maybe one, like, you know, just if I'm feeling like it. So yeah, it has nothing to do with an engineering limit. It's the way that the, you know, you can't pay for everything. You can't, otherwise we'd either run out of money, run out of time, run out of resources to do it. I think the SeaKegel, I was doing a lot of SeaKegel stuff, not working there, but kind of working with them on some issues, and you know, the backlog they have of stuff is ridiculous. There's stuff that have been, there was one configuration that we were actually, it's actually, I think, almost done with SeaKegel now. I wrote the request when I was a captain back in 2014, and it was 2022, and they were just starting to test it. And it wasn't like a very like hard thing. All we were looking for was a supersonic release envelope for GBU-38s. We were 0.95, something like Mach limited. And we're like, yeah, well, this is weird. Like, I can drop the bigger one, supersonic, like 1.2 Mach or something.
Yeah.
I can drop the 500-pound Dumbbond version at like supersonic. Why can't I drop the 500-pound JDAM supersonic? I'm like, oh, we have to do we have to go figure that out. So they're working all that. It got stuck in paperwork for hell for a while. And then you have, you know, flight test money. And anyways, it's a process. It's a thing.
Yeah. Well, I look at it as we have, so again, most of my experience is F-16, obviously, but we have F-16s who over G, I wouldn't say a lot, but it's not uncommon, especially when people are doing like low altitude ingress to attacks to over G.
Oh yeah.
So how many man hours are we spending on like, oh, you over-G'd the jet. Now maintenance has to like take the wings apart or, you know, do some inspections. And we could save all that time. But then, you know, how much are we really saving money-wise? So I get it. I mean,
I'm convinced that in the F-15, there's like different levels of over-G. There's like level one, level two, level three. Then there's like mass items, which is like the, you know, the fuselage. So you will, I don't know if you have it yet, you've only flown three times, you will over-G the F-15 at some point. And then the first thing you do, like in your, when you do like your BFM phase, you'll probably have like your hours, like just to scroll through. So you'll program into your screens, you scroll through, it's like over-G, you bring it up and you're like, okay, level one, no mass items, like continue. And then, you know, over-G is the second time or the third time, like, all right, we're doing something wrong. Let's bring it back. But you know, if you have mass items or like a low, I'm pretty sure level one, no mass items, is like the engineering buffer to go like, hey, be careful. But when you get to like, hey, it's level three on like, you know, several items and mass items, you're like, oh, like that's like probably bent the jet. Like, you know, I've heard of guys, a couple of like strikey guys, you know, doing like a emergency recovery to like avoid hitting the ground, and you know they spike like 10, a little bit over 10 G's, like right out of Top Gun Maverick, seriously. They bring the, and it's all like, you know, over G, and it's like the whole OWS page is just lit up with over G. Like, well, that jet's gonna be down for a little bit. Now they have to pull the panels.
So, like 130% of the exactly. Like allotment.
I want to say that's what it is. Like if it's a level one, it's like, I don't know, 100 to 110% or something like that. Level two is like 120. I don't know. It's been a while.
But yeah, that's, well, I've looked at that and I think I was talking to Bender about it. Like I'm just relegating myself to, I'm just going to have weak brake turns because it's just having flown side stick that moves a quarter of an inch for literally a decade. And now they're like two thirds stick travel to a known stick position. I'm like, that does not make sense in my brain. Like I don't have like this innate currently ability just to like find the same spot over and over without overshooting to an over G. So I'm like, 6.5 G's is probably all I'm going to do in a brake turn. And then I'll make it up, you know, in the control zone. But, it's cool because it's very different.
The amount of time, because it's, again, it's the F-15C and the E are cable pulley with, you know, hydro assist with some computer augmentation. Bender's man, he's just hurting trying to get back into this conversation.
Close some apps in
that. He's in stealth mode now. He's F-35 guy. We can't see him.
Yeah. There he is. Sorry, hey, everybody. Back. This is going to be nightmare to edit. Yeah.
Awesome. Yeah, so the amount of time, and you're probably starting to see this, like in a, you know, teaching someone to fly the F-15 to fly it good, like max perform the jet within visual range is like thousands and thousands of hours of studying and just thinking through how to do this. And those skills actually all atrophy, right? Where like the Viper, no, I'm just going to pull.
Yeah.
Like, well, just skip to the good stuff. I'll tell you, like the E model is different because it has CFTs and pods, unless we take the pods off. But generally we fly with CFTs all the time, with like one or two exceptions right now going on in the real world. So when you can't fly the E model the same as the C model, even though it's kind of based on the same flight control system. But because of the way that the weight on the jet is, and it's a much heavier jet, if you pull the stick and you do the stick mechanic just right, the G number, it literally just flashes for like, you know, 1/20th of a second. It'll spike that fast and then it'll, you know, come right back down. So you can pull like a, you know, like an 8G brake turn is a really good in a Strike Eagle. But how you get that with the stick position, there's a thing that's called an inertial overshoot. And so when you get past that 3/4 position, if you pause just right and you're at the right airspeed and the right weight and you pull the stick just right, the jet will actually snap about 50 degrees a second. The nose, it'll track for about 1 to 1.5 seconds, and then it'll slow down and your G will bleed off. But it's fun if you do it right, because you can really whip the nose around one time.
Yeah.
And it does some other weird tricks just based on the weight. But yeah, it's definitely not. It's really hard to be good, and it's really, really hard to stay good without doing it all the time. And, you know, it's not a flying club. We have missions to do. So when people go out and like, we're just going to do BFM for the next like 6 weeks and be awesome at it, like, no one cares.
Yeah.
No one cares but you in the bar, man. Like, that's not gonna win or lose the next war. I'm sorry.
Yeah, that's what I'm finding is, I mean, they even say it to my face. They're like, hey, you can't just like pull and stay awake now. You actually have to fly the jet. And I'm like, yeah, that's becoming apparent, because it's different. Because if you pull and you now set too much units of AOA, like cockpit units of AOA, the jet stops doing what you want. So you're like, this is, you know, it's not like I get more infinitely. I get more to a point and then it's diminishing returns. And now you're just hurting yourself. And I'm like, I'm not good at any of this. So it'll take a little while.
Yeah. Have you gotten through the AHC where you're basically flying it by feel?
That's cause I was not effective. The sortie, my two sorties from now will be that one. And it's okay. Dual, which I was looking forward to being solo, but apparently when you can put the jet out of control, it's probably best to be dual.
Yeah. The AOA thing is, it definitely feels different at different AOA regimes, and you start to get a feel for it. And then you realize like, oh, those are actually just crutches, because it's based on my weight, airspeed, and altitude. It's like, and so the faster I go, those rules don't apply. If I'm slower, it changes. If I'm higher, the air density is different. Doesn't matter. If I'm heavier, it changes. Doesn't matter. I'm like, oh, they're crutches we used to teach like new guys. But when you go out, turns out when you go fly like BFM, everyone's in the same configuration every time we do it. So that's kind of just become a rule.
Yeah. Well, and that's one of the things, the buffet that you don't really experience in the F-16. It's actually been a little reassuring, like around the final turn and you're in the light buffet and you're like, hey, son of a gun, that's, you know, it's kind of just like they say, the jet talks to you. And it definitely does. Like it advises me how bad I am at flying the C model. So
yeah, when you get real fast in it, it'll tell you that it doesn't like to go too fast. You're like, I am actually a little scared right now.
Yeah. Well, they say the eagle roar that you get just from the air, like traveling over the canopy. That's like,
yeah, it's a thing. It gets loud.
Intense. Yeah.
Yeah.
Hopefully I'm nice and high and fast, but that's, you know, what the F-16 doesn't get to do as well. So
when you do your, like your tactical intercepts, you're getting the, you know, high 40s, like 1.2 Mach, 1.4 Mach, somewhere in that area. I've seen those guys kind of on a commit, and then you go out down to like 20,000 feet, recommit back up to 40,000 feet, and you're like, geez, it's like a flying yo-yo.
Yeah. Well, that's like the stuff the Raptor does too. Like, Bender and I were in Red Flag, Alaska, and it was one of those like four F-16s with one Raptor in the lane, and the F-22 he's like, same thing. He's in the 40s. He's just doing work. And I watch him leave down, like just to send pure vertical down into the 20s. and then pass us. And he's like, hey, go shoot those guys. And then by the time we're turning back around, he's back in the 40s, like passing us again. And I was like, this is insane. Like, I don't know how these planes do this, you know?
I did a, did a red air vol back when I was a weapons officer. And I, the very few times I get to fly red air as a break, and it was a fight tank fight with, it was a mix of Strike Eagles and Raptors. We had two squadrons kind of deployed together. And I forgot what the numbers were. I don't know, it was probably like a 8v8 or something like that when we had tankers. And it's all right. So after the first fight, we go over. I'm like, all right, everyone. I told like, a pinch of gas is red air. I want to take all of your extra gas. So we end up getting off the tanker, you know, probably 25,000 feet with 30,000 pounds of gas because we have tanks. Like, all right, we're going to be the high flash flyer, and we're going to sit on three consecutive PK misses, and we're just going to drive straight. Like, okay. Like I just, I want to see, like, let's, like, I'm DLO shaping here for as Red One, right? So we get up to, you know, it's a Strike Eagle with tanks and captive missiles. So it's got a lot of drag. But eventually, you know, we get up to 48, 49, 50,000 feet. And as soon as you crack the wings, you know, you lose 5,000 feet in, you know, 10-mile turn radius, you know. So we kind of time it. So we're like, we're facing the right way. It's like fight's on. We're at 50,000 feet, right at the, you know, quote, operating limit in that configuration. And, PK miss. And we see, again, we can't, as soon as we crack the wings, we're going to fall out of the sky. So we're just going to go straight. And we see this Raptor. Like, oh, Tally, like, we can't really turn right now. And this Raptor, he's probably like 10,000 feet below us. And he just does this like vertical stern conversion on us.
Enjoy all your favorite sports like never before at BetMGM. Sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. When you register with BetMGM, you'll get instant access to a variety of parlay selection features, live betting options, and the best daily promotions in the business. And with BetMGM at your fingertips, every play and every game matters more than ever. Place your money line, prop, or parlay bets with the king of sportsbooks today. Sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. BetMGM and GameSense remind you to play responsibly. 21 plus and present in Ohio, subject to eligibility requirements. Rewards are non-withdrawable bonus bets that expire in 7 days. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER in partnership with MGM Northfield Park.
As humans, we're naturally driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. When I was looking to hire someone, it was so slow and overwhelming. I wish I had used Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform, with over 350 million global monthly visitors according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And Indeed doesn't just help you hire faster. 93% of employers agree Indeed delivers the highest quality matches compared to other job sites, according to a recent Indeed survey. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/podcast. That's Indeed.com/podcast. Terms and conditions apply.
Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
And it's like, you know, kill, Strike Eagle, Bullseye. It's like PK miss, like gun, kill, like track, like, all right, we're dead. And so we go to turn and it's like, hey, we're falling off left. That's kind of our comm as we crack the wings left and start falling out of the sky. And he just like plugs it in the blower and just goes, just zips away. I'm like, dude, that was amazing. And yeah, that guy could easily, and you guys probably seen this, those, they can get way above 50,000 feet.
Oh, yeah. Well, I was
going
to ask.
They have the aerodynamics and the power to do it. Yeah.
I was going to ask if he was converting from high to low when you were at 50,000 feet.
No, even if it was, I wouldn't tell you that because that's outside of their TO.
But, yeah, that's true.
Yes. I do know that. I do know of a story of a real world mission that had some dip clearance issues, and the squadron weapons officer was the guy leading it, and he's like, "Well, I'm just going to take off and go in the Class A airspace." I'm like, huh? So he takes off and goes completely vertical up the above 50,000 feet out of the country's like jurisdiction airspace, and then just leaves.
Hey.
Like he's within like the aerodrome like airspace confines and just goes vertical up to 50,000 feet. Like,
that's crazy.
Well, that's a technique. Like that is a technique. He got in big trouble when he got back, but I was like, well, you know, made a call.
Yeah. I mean, hey, sometimes you got to do what you got to do. So yeah. One thing that we kind of talked about in text offline was, so we talked to Vermeer, which is Brian Stream from Vermeer, where they're doing like the swarm and all that. And either we talked about it or you sent me an article pretty much, or you were posted about it maybe, about the how complex swarm really is, like a true AI swarm is. So can you kind of explain like exactly when someone says swarm, what they're trying to say, and then why it's such a big ask?
Yeah. So I think, I know what you're talking about now. It was a mob versus a swarm. That's not a swarm.
Yeah.
It's a mob.
Yeah.
those words mean things. It's kind of like, and I can't remember the math, but when you have the number of, points in a system, it scales like logarithmics or exponentially, whatever word you want to use. So if you have 2 points, so you have like say a flight leader and a wingman, there's only one interaction, right? And now if I have 3, and I forget how the math works, the point is when you get to like 10 things, there's like 50 interactions. And the more that you go up, it becomes this like hundreds and hundreds of interactions. And the point is like, it's kind of like back to the mission commander discussion we had, you know, being a 2-ship flight lead and a 4-ship flight lead. It's not like it's twice as hard, right? It's 10 times as hard.
Yeah.
It's the same thing. The amount of variables and considerations to manage something with some kind of, you know, coherence and effectiveness. And, there's a reason why we kind of settled on as like 4 ships. We don't really have like, we don't go out there and fight as 6 ships because that is orders of magnitude even more complex. Like, hey, we can just delegate this stuff down into these sub packages. Turns out we figured this out, you know, 100 years ago in aviation. Hey, about 4 jets is good. Yeah. More than that, it starts to get really, really complicated, logistically and tactically. So that's what it's about. It's when you look at like these drone light shows and things like that, they're not collaborating or coordinating with each other. They're being controlled and directed individually in mass by a single like point. So that'd be like, what if you had like a, you know, like a 30V50 DCA and none of the people that were flying on blue side could actually make decisions. And the AWACS was directing all 30 airplanes and everything, where to go and what to do and how to do it. That's kind of like what most of this stuff is. If you put a lot of quadcopters in the same piece of sky, like they're probably not even controlled by the same person. And so that's actually a mob, right? And that was kind of my point. Like if you're looking at something that's actually network collaborative autonomy, NCA, that is where you get to like wicked, wicked complexity. And I tell you that there's, you know, it's a niche and we're getting better at it, but there's probably like, you know, the amount of people in like the US defense industrial base that have the expertise and the know-how and the knowledge to do that. There's not many, and I'm not talking companies, I'm talking people, just people like the universities, the whole academic system to build the people who can even understand and how to do this. And then you have to, you know, mature them and experience them into that market. Talking with someone the other day about, some form of this, with autonomy, I was like, you realize like, how many fighter pilots there are in the Air Force? There is less than that many people in the entire United States who know how to do any of this. And that's not the good ones. That's just total.
Yeah. Right?
And you go like, you know, you want the joke is like, you want to hire the guy, who's, you know, designing, you know, what the shape and the color of your Facebook app button should be, or do you want to hire the guy that's like better than the guy that Tesla hired to build their like auto driving algorithm? Like, which one do you want to work for?
Yeah. Well, you know, and
it turns out that's not cheap.
Yeah. And how do you hire those people? Cause that's the tough part. Like, as a DoD organization, how are you able to pay in a manner that's competitive with Tesla or SpaceX or, you know, cause those are some pretty cool problem sets, you know, like the military is cool problem sets, but I mean, those
patriotism
people
only goes so far, right?
Yeah.
These are all conversations that I'm involved with the Air Force right now. And, you know, we go out and recruit, top talent and we, compensate top talent so they can produce top tier stuff, right, for the warfighter. But at the end of the day, the government has to buy it, right? And so when you look at the government acquisitions systems and how they buy things, they're not buying based on quality or value. They're basing it off of cost. And they go, well, like it's happening more and more. I would say every new defense company that's kind of advanced technology is kind of fighting this right now, which is, you know, we are hiring some of the best people in the world to do this because it literally does not exist. And we're doing it. And you go, great. Well, how much does it cost? Well, let's look at your labor rates and then, oh, your labor rates are too high. We're not going to pay for that. Like, well, so let me get this straight. So what if, like, let's hypothetically, a company found a way to solve world hunger? The government, and this is what's wrong with the government acquisitions process, they would go, okay, well, instead of going like, well, how many people die every day? You know, say it's 2 million people die every day and we can get this in the field in a month. And then from then on, like, we'll save hundreds of millions of lives. They go, well, how long did it take you to make it? How much money did you put into it? And they start like, let's do the cost analysis to figure out not, it's like, dude, I solved world hunger and you're talking about like, how would I manage my time and engineering headcount to get to the solution, not the value of the solution itself? So there's a massive cultural disconnect between, I would call it your defense 2.0 companies and their business models and the way that government traditionally buys stuff. And so that's why you see like the primes, you know, they live off of cost plus contracts, which is whatever. So all the risk is on the government. There's no risk on the companies. And so what you see is you see a lot of program bloat, whether it's like headcount, so time, resources. So you'll see, you know, this program, it was supposed to take, you know, 5 years and this much money. And it took, you know, 8 years and 50% more money. Well, it took more money because they probably hired more people. And so again, their costs are going up and they just charge the government. And that cost plus, that plus is usually it's a fixed profit margin. So say it's like 12%. So if they cost and they do all the costing analysis and they go, we hired 10 more people, we'll add this to our costs. And guess what? You know, the bigger cost, you know, the percent's the same, but the cost is bigger, then you get more money, right? So they're incentivized to have a larger headcount and not really be efficient and deliver stuff. There's a program. I have a friend of mine in another company. There's a program he's working on, and their technology is ahead of what the Air Force had budgeted for, and they're actually getting in trouble from the program manager because they're ahead of their milestones and they're saving the government money. And the program manager is getting in trouble because like, well, my metrics of how I am graded as a program manager is managing this program. And to me, into that, it means I am on a burn rate for the money I'm obligated and I'm hitting the milestones at the time that I predicted they would be. Like, wait, so we're actually overperforming and it's a bad thing? Like, yes. No. That like there's hundreds of these stories going on every day. It's just a cultural problem. But yeah, so that's one of the things. And if you build a company off of a cost plus contract, like Lockheed Martin's the biggest defense company in the world. I want to say right now they have 130,000 employees. Like if they didn't live off of cost plus contracts, there's no way they would have 130,000 employees, right?
Yeah.
Because they can afford to grow that headcount because they can just pass that back with a cost plus contract. If you take, you know, it takes like Boeing right now, they are a company, all the primes, they're built off of a cost plus model. So they have a large headcount. They went and bid a fixed price contract, which is like, you know, when you go to the store and you buy an iPhone, you don't buy the iPhone based on how much money it costs Apple to build it, and then, you know, add 12% or whatever it is. You go, this is the price. If you go, yeah, that's a good price based on what, you know, the value that I'm going to get out of buying my iPhone, I'll buy the iPhone. So Boeing's switched that for a lot of their defense programs to try to gain market share by incurring risk from the government. So in a fixed price contract, the contractor has all the risk. If it goes over that price, like, it doesn't matter. The government's not paying for it. They're only paying what they said they're going to pay. That's the point of a fixed price. So your MQ-25, the new Air Force One, which is a VC-25, I believe, the blanking right now. There's like four programs that Boeing had aircraft programs that Boeing had big fixed price contracts on to win, and they've lost billions of dollars. And I think was it last week or week before in the merge, I broke it down and was like, that's, they're losing is like $1 million an hour for like, you know, 90 days straight, 24 hours a day, $1 million an hour. That's their burn rate right now on these like four aircraft programs, because they bid, they're a cost plus company model bidding on a fixed price to try to win some market share. And it's kind of tanking their stock right now.
Well, and it makes sense. Like there's no reason for companies who have that moat and that ability to maintain their market share. Why would they do that? Like, why would they take that extra risk when the cost plus model already exists and they're one of the biggest names in the space, you know? Like, how do we get away with, like, from that?
Yeah, so what you'll see is a lot of the new companies, I would say, I can't think of one off the top of my head, a defense company that's been started in the last 5 years, 10 years, call it, that does cost plus. Like, they have, everyone has sworn off cost plus contracts. For a startup, it makes no sense, because you're limiting your revenue, right? You're trying to deliver value, gain market share. If you're a blue chip company like Lockheed Martin, like, yeah, you can afford to just go, yeah, cost plus, we'll just, you know, keep the lights on. It's a, you know, like an S&P 500 stock probably. So it's got it stable. It's not a growth stock. So there are different company phases of a company. And I think those models work for different phases of that. So if you want new people in the market, you got to have the business models that align with the newer companies that are coming into the market. It's the same way. It's not just defense. It's just economics, right? So like when you get into, you know, you can talk about the consolidation of defense and all that. And, if you like to talk about innovation and just like the different stages of a company or an organization as they grow, how they innovate actually changes. And it's pretty fascinating. So we like to think of like, a lot of like garage lab kind of innovation stuff, whether it's like the two pizza rule from like, you know, Jeff Bezos. And there's a few other models. At the end of the day, there's a point where a company switches, and the way that they innovate is they don't actually do the work. They innovate through acquisitions.
Yeah.
So, like Apple is a great example. Like we think of them as like, you know, bleeding edge tech and just delivering just amazing like products. The reality is almost everything that they've done is through buying other companies that had that tech and they just integrated it.
Yeah, like Beats.
So Apple in their history has acquired more companies than Lockheed Martin in their entire history.
That's wild.
So I did the math, like they're up to about 80. So Apple has bought 80 companies. They average, they buy a few a year. Some of them are big, some are small. And then, in the peak, they were probably averaging, like they were buying one company a month back in like 2019, 2020. And if you look at their acquisitions, you can go back and look at what they bought in the timelines. You can go, oh yeah, like they were thinking about changing this, getting into ads and locking out Facebook. They were thinking about this 8 years ago. Like, look at the companies they're buying. They're buying ad companies. Like, I know why they're buying ad companies now.
Yeah. See, and I mean, good on them. Cause like you said, like they can't stay that young, innovative, like startup forever. So they get that acquisitions and then someday they just become a big bloated bureaucracy of a company, I guess. Not, I say that, but not in a bad way, but just at some point you're a massive company. So you kind of aren't as nimble as you used to be when you were, like you said, the two pizza rule, you know?
Yeah. Everyone loves the underdog. It turns out if the the underdog has catastrophic success, eventually he's going to be the villain.
Yeah.
That's just how we think about companies in life, I guess. If you're too successful, it's bad. If you're the, everyone loves the underdog. I'm always rooting for Rocky.
Yeah. Well, we grew up that way. You know, that was our experience when we were a kid, you know, Rocky or Bloodsport, you know, like, oh, how is Jean-Claude Van Damme going to do this?
But did you just, you just threw out a Jean-Claude Van Damme reference, right?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. To my mom's chagrin, that's what I grew up on. You know, it was like Terminator, Commando, like all that kind of stuff. This is my perspective and it could be completely wrong. So back in the day, my understanding is that the government, like trying to go to the moon, was the leading edge, like the most cutting edge place to be if you're trying to solve problems. And then technology was like downstream from what the government and like NASA was trying to achieve. But nowadays it's almost like the government can't keep up with what public companies and all these companies out there can produce. So why did that change?
And maybe- well, yeah, I'd say a few things. So if you go back to World War II, there's a couple of good books about it, but if you look at this, there's a book called The Secret History of Silicon Valley. And it goes back to like, how did Silicon Valley actually have all of this, like these tech companies, like where do they actually all come from? And if you go from like down to like, down south, an actual Silicon Valley up to like, you know, the Bay Area and San Francisco back in World War II, like all of the government, like technology that we use to like fight World War II was built there. Those were all defense companies. So Silicon Valley was like built on the back of national security. And what had happened over time, there was a switch in the Cold War, and I can't remember exactly when, but the model kind of changed where the government started instituting processes that were, they basically adopted it from Ford Motor Company, if you believe it or not. Robert McNamara took over in the Pentagon as the Secretary of Defense, and he brought with him a bunch of the executives from Ford, and they tried to implement a bunch of business models and of, you know, how do we have predictable planning and how do I get to the nth degree of metrics and all of these processes to drive stability. And so that's what you did. So you're trading speed for stability and predictability. And so that's what happened. And so all of the things that came out of that, no kidding, is like how everything that we have today was built then. The PBBE and the like the fiscal years and how that actually works, like all that was in the 1960s timeframe. And what happened was it's still from the 1960s and the world has changed. And so I'd say probably probably the late 90s, the where you would find breakthroughs started to change. There was a few reasons why. And so I'd say in the 80s, you have government funded research and you would, you know, bleeding edge stuff, you know, DARPA's, you know, built the internet, all that kind of stuff. And now, you know, 20 years later, when you look at like where the money is and the rise of even venture capital, they're making bets and tech companies, you'll see just the amount of money where it is. It's not even close. I want to say it's like 10 to one, it's probably like 30 to one dollars. So for every dollar that the government invests in like, you know, S&T or R&D to like technology development, it's 30 times more money in the commercial sector doing that. And so they're able to, they don't have, you know, the federal acquisitions regulations. They don't have colors of money in fiscal years. They don't have continuing resolutions. They don't have congressional oversight, right? It's a free market economy in that regard. So you can move as at the speed of business. It turns out the speed of business is the speed of you know, life, the real world, where the speed of government is something completely different. And the longer that disconnect remains, I think everyone, probably in the past 5 years, everyone's like, oh, we have a problem. Like the industry is like running circles around what the government is able to do just because of our processes. Even if we could buy, and then we get to the things back to earlier, you know, say a company like, you know, we built something, you know, this exquisite technology, the government wants to buy it. Well, now the latest thing is the government wants to own, you know, they want to own the architecture. They want to own the tech stack. Like, okay, well, who's going to maintain it? Because like the guys who built it, they're not GS15s. I don't know how to tell you this, but I don't think you're going to be able to do this. So when you look at government reference architectures, open systems architectures, and things like that, that you can speed a lot. But at the end of the day, like when you field something, someone has to, you know, maintain and sustain it. And there's a conversation to be had of who has the expertise to do that. And if it's going to be the government just contracting back to the people who know what they're doing to do it, then you're like, well, what's the whole point of having this this reference? Like, who cares what the reference is? You're not doing anything with it. You might as well just keep the open standard and then change what's running on the open standard instead of wanting your own, you know, operating system that's government. The government owns it. So it's an interesting conversation right now with, I was joking with someone the other day during an engagement. I was like, if you could tell me one example of a government run software program that is like a catastrophic success, I will show you 100 that are catastrophic failures. Yeah. Like, I just got two words for you: PEX and JUMPS. Like, yeah, all right. No. Like, if we can't even figure out how to schedule these squadron scheduling and, you know, do mission planning, like those are two basic stuff that everyone touches every day. And somehow I don't know, 15 years into trying to fix it, and we keep just making it worse. So
I think one of the frustrating things is they, at least in scheduling, the DoD seems more interested in finding a solution, and there's a lot of companies working in that space, but they seem so uninterested in changing mission planning, you know, to something that represents some new technology. I mean, you go to a red flag, and who else around the world would say you're going to put 70 aircraft in the same airspace and they're all worth multiple millions of dollars at least, and you're going to plan all this, the deconfliction, the timing, the everything, on a literal whiteboard and transfer that to an Excel document that may or may not have macros in it, you know, or like formulas. But that's it. Like, that is the extent of our mission planning.
That has not changed in 30 years.
Yeah.
We fought Desert Storm on that same whiteboard and probably that same Excel, you know, document.
And that's the frustrating thing, where it's good that in some areas they are very interested in finding solutions. Maybe it's just such a niche solution that they're like, this is very operator centric, that it's not that noticeable to anybody who doesn't mission plan and especially on a large scale.
Yeah, it's frustrating. I think again, you go back to like, well, what's the impact? There's only how many PEC systems are there in use? I don't know. I'm making it up. Maybe there's 100, right? Yeah. Like, oh, well, the business case just isn't there for us to like, you know, build something. Like, well, yeah, it is. You see all the people that you're pissing off every day? Like, they're all going to leave. That's your problem. You have a retention problem because their quality of life sucks because you're giving them like tech from the 1990s and you're asking them to go do miracles with it. Like, how about you start with like the low hanging fruit and fix some of these pain points? And when you say you're going to fix something, I don't know, how about you follow through and do it? Like, show me your report card. Like, here are all the things that you've promised over the past 10 years that you're going to fix. None of them have been fixed. Or, hey, this, did we fix this? We failed here. Like, great. Like, that would be nice to know. But lots of broken promises. That trail of tears to the exit door is,
yeah,
well, it's a thing.
It's frustrating because everything's downstream from the schedule. It's the scheduler's life is terrible. The ADO, his life is terrible because he has to, you know, buy the schedule and then sell the schedule to the DO. So all of their lives are suboptimal. And then a bad schedule affects the entire squadron. And so you're like, everybody is part, yeah, like feels the pain of the schedule. If only we could solve that, which we've talked with Ops Lab in the past, and we actually just talked with Duality the other day. So that'll be coming out in a couple weeks. But yeah, there's companies out there that are trying to solve it, but that's the question, is like, how does it replace PEX? You know, like, that's a going from a, hey, this Cyber 2 made good and it's a MVP that works, to PEX is gone, this took its place. Like, that is quite a bit different.
Yeah, I'd say the PEX, the more you learn about PEX, you go, oh, this is way more complicated of a problem. So the side of pecs that, you know, as a as an operator fighter pilot deals with is like 10%. Like there's a maintenance side of pecs. They use, there's a whole other like galaxy of stuff that they use pecs for over there. So there has to be some kind of continuity until they, you know, replace pecs entirely. But yeah, you could do your schedule. There's a whole bunch of things to do. Like, you know, the Air Force, we, you know, by Friday morning in a normal fighter squadron, unless things have changed, by Friday morning, you have like your, everyone kind of sits in the scheduling and like kind of slaps the table and go, they've spent probably an hour and a half moving the final touches to make the perfect schedule for the next Monday through Friday, like fly week. And then no kidding, but by the time that the end of day, that Friday that they just like blessed the schedule, something's already changed.
Yeah.
So I used to keep track of like how many things would change throughout the week. I'm a two-time recovering scheduler. So, so I did it a few different assignments. So I appreciate it. And it was like, I used to put a dot and I remember like, well, I didn't tell anyone, I was doing it for just my own experiment. And the end of the week, you know, you don't clean the board from like, you know, this week, next week, as you're building, you're like, what, where are all these dots? And I was like, the DO was asking, I'm like, oh, you mean on Friday? Like, hey, it's Friday. Like there's a dot next to every single puck on the board. They're like, yeah, why is that? Like, that means that I have literally moved every single, that is not the schedule you approved. Like I moved every single puck because of that cascading effects of like one thing leads to another. And you know, if this happens, I like the Navy technique, which is, you know, day plus one, plus two. And so you have your availability and you just go, am I flying like AM go or PM go? And if I'm flying AM go, like keep me in the AM go. And if I'm not available, like, you know, Tuesday, don't schedule me. I have an office day. And then they go, all right. And then you just figure out like, hey, we're on the schedule. Great. What do you want to do? And it's, you know, plan early, plan often, but for the Air Force. So these people are like, oh, I have this ride in 5 days. Let me go start studying and prepping. And the Navy's like, what am I doing tomorrow? Like, oh, okay.
Yeah. Which so, again, like all it is like broken dreams on the week out.
Oh know? Yeah.
Like yeah. Me, like I, yeah. Oh, go ahead.
Yeah, I was going to say, you show me, it's like the perfect sortie. Like, show me a fighter pilot who's ever flown a perfect sortie, and I'll show you a schedule that's been executed as planned, right?
Yeah, well, and that's the problem. Like, you build a schedule that assumes that you're going to have success on a day prior. There's not going to be weather problem. But if only you could build a schedule that wasn't, like, didn't explode because of, you know, the Friday fallout that rolls into Monday, which rolls into Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday. Like, I don't think there is a way to build a schedule with upgrades and all those things without that, like the following days rely on the days prior. But maybe if there's a computer that just does the reroll, at least it saves humans from trying to do it. And then, you know, stepping on someone's office day, 'cause they were like, oh shoot, I forgot about that. Like, I mean, I can only imagine.
Yeah, you should be able to put in your, it's kind of like the like puck board, which for like the tanker planning, you should be able to just hear my inputs, hear my priorities, and you go compute, and it basically gives you, here's your suggested schedule, and you go, I don't like that, compute again, like, okay, this is pretty close, I just move one or two things around, and like I just skip to the good stuff, right? Like,
yeah.
the value of a scheduler is like that last 10%. Mm-hmm. Like that's where you really want the hands on the pucks making those decisions, because you have the context. But like the first 90% of it is like, that is not hard work. That is just tedious waste of time.
Well, and I think that's a nice thing, because a lot of these automated schedulers will do exactly that. I like that formation, leave it as is, and you lock it. All right. You know, I always forget the name where you're doing all the weaponeering with all like the 1,000 bombs or whatever. It's not roulette. It's it's like a gambling something where the
like a Monte Carlo
exactly
simulation?
Like, yeah, okay. The Monte Carlo where you're just like, all right, send it, figure out the best solution, and we'll go from there, kind of thing. And so yeah, I mean, people are out there, they're trying to solve it, so that's good.
I learned recently, and I've already forgotten, so I'm gonna screw this up. I should probably Google this as we're talking here. I actually learned, like, so what Monte Carlo actually is, like everyone's like, oh, it's a Monte Carlo, run the simulation. All it means is that it's a time limited like permutations that it's running. Mm-hmm. And at the end of it, it goes, this is what I got based on the time. There's another kind of permutation predictor, where it's not time based, it's like solutions based, and that one's called like, you know, Las Vegas or something. It's got some other like geographic, of course, like who comes up with these names?
Yeah. But I like that one more.
I cannot remember. It's definitely, I want to say, I don't know the name of it, but it's definitely a geographic location. I was like, that's funny. Whoever came up with these names, like, you know, 30, 40 years ago, like that's funny.
Yeah. But I like that more because now it's not, hey, my solution is based off my time constraint. It's based off of my scheduling or availability or whatever it is. But at least that's a better constraint than, hey, you gave me 6 seconds, you know? And it's like, well, that's not helpful. So, yeah. The what are some of the things? Obviously, you've got your hands in a lot of stuff in the innovation space. What's something cool that you've kind of seen recently before we get out of here?
Oh, I don't know. Let's see. There's a lot of cool stuff going on. Nothing really jumps out at me because there's literally, I don't know. I probably see 500 things a week when I'm building the newsletter.
Yeah.
And so I'm running an experiment right now. I realized like I can't put everything in the newsletter, and I was spending a lot of time just making choices of where that cut line's supposed to be, because I can only have so much space in the newsletter, and it's just going to get, you know, overwhelming. And it comes out every Sunday morning. So I was like, well, I have all this good stuff and I just haven't been able to use it because it's just below the cut line. And I'm like, so I've been spent a lot of time doing that. So finally I was like, what if I just took the stuff below the cut line and then just released it separately? So I created kind of I'm running an experiment on LinkedIn because LinkedIn has a built-in newsletter function.
Oh, nice.
Where on Tuesday mornings, I'm putting all of the saved rounds that I couldn't put in the newsletter. I'm putting all the saved rounds you saw on Sunday, and then I have like below the cut line and like here are all the other ones. And so I think this last Tuesday, I probably had like, I don't know, maybe 10 or 12, 10, maybe 15 saved rounds. And I had like 30 or 40 things that I just could not fit. Like there's a lot of stuff going on in the defense tech space right now. So it's, instead of, you know, singling out one, I would say, sign up for the newsletter. I'd really appreciate it. It's a lot of work. However much work you think it is, it's probably, you're underestimating. It's a lot of my time, but it's a labor of love. I appreciate it. And, I really enjoy the notes and the feedback that I get. So I'm going to keep doing it. Sometimes, you know, I love doing it some days, and some days I'm like, man, I just got to get this thing done because there's a lot of people counting on me, and I don't want to let them all down. So,
well, yeah, I appreciate it because I, having kind of an understanding of the space and stuff, and then obviously you have a very good understanding of it. It is super useful information, and it's stuff that reading it, you're like, hey, that could move the needle, or this is why the needle's not moving, or, you know, we're talking about a couple months back, you had, I think it was a couple months now, the Valley of Death stuff. And there's just so much information that it's, because you produce it every week, it's very topical. So I've been, you know, I follow the Merge on Instagram and LinkedIn, obviously. And so seeing some of the Instagram pictures and articles and stories you put up, it's cool. So I highly recommend themerge.co. Is that it, right, for the website?
Yep.
Yeah.
Yep, www.themerge.co.
Perfect. So, well, everybody go check that out. I'll throw it in the show notes as we did last time. And I highly recommend it because I read it every Sunday, and then I follow all the stuff on LinkedIn. But, Paco, we'll have to do this again. Thanks for coming out here and chatting. And then, sorry, everybody, but Bender, he fell off a while ago, and we just let him go. We didn't even slow down the recording.
Standard F-35 guy doesn't make the push, I tell you.
Yeah. You'd think timing would be easy in that thing.
Yeah.
Enjoy all your favorite sports like never before at BetMGM. Sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. When you register with BetMGM, you'll get instant access to a variety of parlay selection features, live betting options, and the best daily promotions in the business. And with BetMGM at your fingertips, every play and every game matters more than ever. Place your money line, prop, or parlay bets with the king of sportsbooks today. Sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. BetMGM and GameSense remind you to play responsibly. 21 plus and present in Ohio, subject to eligibility requirements. Rewards are non-withdrawable bonus bets that expire in 7 days. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER in partnership with MGM Northfield Park.
As humans, we're naturally driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. When I was looking to hire someone, it was so slow and overwhelming. I wish I had used Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform, with over 350 million global monthly visitors according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And Indeed doesn't just help you hire faster. 93% of employers agree Indeed delivers the highest quality matches compared to other job sites, according to a recent Indeed survey. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/podcast. That's Indeed.com/podcast. Terms and conditions apply.